Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hurricane season starts in less than 2 weeks, but in Washington, the storm has arrived, and already it's Category 4.
We hear from some quarters nothing but feigned outrage based on a false narrative.
There's the former Vice President Dick Cheney yesterday, and just a few blocks away was the president.
In dealing with the situation, we don't have the luxury of starting from scratch. We're cleaning up something that is quite simply a mess.
High winds and high stakes on national security. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 22nd. John Hockenberry is away. I'm Todd Zwillick, along with Catherine Lamper. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Todd. Coming up this hour, we go to New Orleans for hurricane season and to Beirut for election season, plus another look at the terror plot in New York. All this and more, but first, these headlines.
This afternoon, the president is signing a bill that will change the plastic in your wallet. The bill restricts companies' ability to amp up interest rates on your credit card. It also makes it harder for people under 21 to get cards. Card companies fought hard against these new rules. Analysts say they may try to make up for lost profits by raising fees or ditching reward programs, even for responsible cardholders. The president speaks to graduates at the U.S. Naval Academy later this morning. Unlike his recent commencement speeches, this one is free of controversial baggage about abortion or honorary degrees, but it's not without its own intrigue. One of the graduates at the U.S. Naval Academy is Senator John McCain's son. Four generations of McCains have been through Annapolis. Some graduated near the top of their class and some near the bottom, Senator. Had the election gone differently, McCain might be behind the podium himself. Today, he's expected to be in the audience.
Wet weather is forcing NASA to scrap the first landing time for the space shuttle Atlantis. If weather approves, it could still land later this morning. The shuttle can also try again tomorrow, reroute perhaps to California or New Mexico. If Atlantis lands across the country, though, it costs nearly $2 million to haul it back to Florida. Astronauts spiffed up the Hubble Space Telescope, adding at least 5 years of life to it. And an American journalist held captive in Iran is headed back to the U.S. The State Department says that Roxana Souberi flew home today. Iran held her prisoner for weeks, convicting her of spying charges in a trial. She was freed early this month and spent a week in Austria in recuperation.
Looking overseas, the U.N. wants more than $500 million to help refugees fleeing the war in Pakistan. The Pakistani army is in a tough fight with the Taliban in Swat Valley and elsewhere. The government estimates nearly 2 million people have fled the violence since the offensive started there last month. The UN is starting a fundraising appeal today.
A new bill will add tens of billions of dollars to the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan, among other new spending, but it strips out money President Obama wanted to use to close the Guantanamo Bay prison. The Senate passed the more than $91 billion war spending bill last night.
The S&P and Dow each lost more than 1.5%. The S&P is at 888. The Dow will start trading today at 8292. So we're talking about distractions today, distractions like Facebook and tweets and emails and phone calls and Blackberries and instant message. And we want to know what distracts you the most and what are your strategies for getting your focus back. Tell us your stories at 8778-MYTAKE. Email us with much focus at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Former Vice President Dick Cheney spoke in Washington yesterday and positioned himself only a few blocks away and only a few minutes after a speech by the president on America's national security strategy. Cheney defended his views on the interrogation tactic he helped to implement under the Bush administration.
Today, I want to set forth the strategic thinking behind our policies. I do so as one who was there every day of the Bush administration. who supported the policies when they were made and without hesitation would do so again in the same circumstances.
Well, Vice President Cheney isn't vice president anymore, but he's sure not giving up on criticism or on aggressive debate or on trying to get what he wants out of Washington. So we're going to talk with someone who can hopefully help us get inside Dick Cheney's brain a little bit. Jake Bernstein is a reporter for ProPublica, and he's co-author of the Cheney biography, Vice, Dick Cheney and the Hijacking of the American Presidency. Jake, the former vice president said yesterday, in effect, that if he had the chance to do all of this all over again, he would do it exactly the same way. Is that the Dick Cheney that you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is not a guy who second-guesses himself or you know, changes his mind later on. I mean, he's very consistent.
Okay, he's very consistent, so he doesn't change his mind like maybe a lot of men his age, certainly a lot of politicians his age, I guess. But it's a longstanding tradition in Washington that former presidents, former vice presidents kind of fade into the background a little bit and let the new administration do their work. But Cheney's not doing that at all. He's not only speaking out, he's scheduling a speech right after Obama's. He schedules it a few blocks away from the National Archives in Washington. Does this kind of behavior surprise you at all?
Yeah, what is that old saying? We can't miss you if you won't go away. yeah, this is very unorthodox for a vice president or a president to speak out like this. But given the stakes and how firmly and passionately he believes in this stuff, ultimately, I don't think I'm surprised.
Okay, well, let me play you another cut from the speech yesterday because it sort of goes back to what you were saying, that the vice president is a man who doesn't change his mind, but he's also commenting on how we're going to change our national security strategy now that there's a new administration in town.
I was and remain a strong proponent of our enhanced interrogation program. The interrogations were used on hardened terrorists after other efforts had failed. They were legal, essential, justified, successful, and the right thing to do.
Anything new from the vice president here? Have we heard all this before? Is there anything new in his message yesterday?
Well, we've heard it before, but, I mean, there's certainly evidence out there that seems to contradict what he said. I mean, it's not clear or decided that other techniques wouldn't have worked just as well. And in fact, the FBI was getting some results from sort of regular interrogation before torture was used or enhanced interrogation techniques, whatever they're calling it. So, I mean, the vice president likes to speak with firmness and as if all these matters are closed. But it's not quite as clear-cut as he laid out in the speech.
You know, there's been some suggestion that at the end of the Bush administration, Dick Cheney had to keep quiet, even though things weren't always going his way, that some of the policy was strained from his direction. So whose legacy is he trying to protect here with all of these speeches?
Well, I think he's definitely it's not just his legacy that he's trying to protect, although that's clearly part of it, but it's an ideology that he's trying to protect. You know, he believes in a strong executive. He believes in this wartime president that has sort of unfettered power, and he's going to fight for that. I mean, that's something that he wants. You know, he thinks is the direction of America should be, and he's not going to back away from that. There's also a loyalty factor here, and you can see it in this speech. I mean, the way he ends, his closest aides were in the forefront of pushing this policy, in particular David Addington, who was his legal counsel and then his chief of staff. And so he's going to do everything he can to try and protect them.
Because he might be, well, Addington and John Yoo and potentially Jay Bybee, who's a judge now, were all lawyers at the Office of Legal Counsel, and there's potential legal trouble for them ahead. Do you think he's trying to sort of preemptively defend them in the court of public opinion?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're not people who can particularly speak out, and he can. And he's very, I mean, he believes that loyalty is very important. He was very upset about what happened to his former chief of staff. And so he's
Scooter Libby. Yeah.
Scooter Libby. And so he's not going to he's going to try to avoid that happening to his other lieutenant.
OK, so motivations aside, Jake, what can the vice I want to ask. How well can the former vice president really affect the debate in Washington? Is he trying to affect it on an emotional ground, on a policy ground. Certainly the Republicans in Congress have been throwing bombs on Nancy Pelosi for who knew what and when. It seems like almost like a political attack. Is Cheney trying to shift the debate on policy grounds? What's he trying to do here?
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because John McCain told a reporter yesterday that, obviously the vice president can speak if he wants. He's free to talk. But McCain said, "I just don't see where it helps." Uh-huh. I mean, I think there are a lot of Republicans who would love to see Dick Cheney go away. In a lot of ways, I think this helps Obama. It allows him to crystallize sort of an opposing idea. Cheney is sort of a straw man. I mean, I think it's a good thing for Democrats probably. So I'm not entirely sure how effective Cheney will be in pushing his thought across. I mean, there's some speculation that he wants these ideas out there in case, heaven forbid, there is another terrorist attack, and then he can say, "I told you so."
Mm-hmm.
But what the effect of this will be or how long Cheney will be able to sustain his argument remains to be seen.
All right. Well, let's hear from the president, because we've spent this entire segment talking about the former vice president, his criticisms of the current administration. Let's give a listen to Barack Obama. It sounds like a rebuttal, but his speech actually came first yesterday. So let's give a listen to this.
I know some have argued that brutal methods like waterboarding were necessary to keep us safe. I could not disagree more. As Commander-in-Chief, I see the intelligence. I bear the responsibility for keeping this country safe. And I categorically reject the assertion that these are the most effective means of interrogation.
Applause line. So the president knew what the former vice president was going to say before he said it.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't any surprises here, not really from the president and certainly not from the vice president, a former vice president. I mean, their positions at this point are pretty clear.
Okay, then let me ask you about the politics real quick, because there is also a school of thought in Washington. Well, there's not a school of thought. There is a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. They're in the minority in the House and the Senate. They don't have the White House. And you sort of see this battle of Republicans trying to decide who they're going to be in the future. One school of thought says, well, the country might be more moderate than we are. They elected Barack Obama. They sent us into the minority, even in conservative districts across the country. We need to appeal to a much broader swath of the American public. And here comes Dick Cheney. He's been on TV more than once. Basically saying, no, we have to crystallize our party, be more conservative, more defined, maybe spend a couple years in the wilderness and tell people who we really are. So it seems to me that there's a political element also to what he's doing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a really important subtext, Todd. Cheney sort of espouses and embodies a certain kind of authoritarianism strain in the Republican Party, and he thinks that that's not only an important, ideologically and correct ideologically, but it's a winning strategy. I mean, I really think that Cheney probably believes that at some point or another, the country is going to want more of that authoritarianism, and if the Republican Party stays true to that, then they will be there when the country needs that.
Okay, but you just mentioned McCain and other Republicans who are saying he can talk when he wants, but it doesn't necessarily help us. Are Republicans going to continue to allow him to have this bully pulpit?
Well, I mean, there's not much they can do about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, he's got the think tanks, and he's supposedly working on a book, and I think we're going to have Cheney for a while.
You think we've got Cheney for a while?
Yeah, I mean, unless, heaven forbid something happens to him,
okay.
But I don't think he's going away. I mean, this is not one final lap. I think he's got a lot more laps left in him.
Okay, well, more debate to come on national security, more debate to come on the future of the Republican Party. We expect the former vice president to be part of it all. He's not going anywhere. Jake Bernstein is a reporter for ProPublica and co-author of Vice, Dick Cheney, and the Hijacking of the American Presidency. Well, we want to hear from you at 8778-MY-TAKE. We want your emails at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can react to this story, but we also want to hear about your distractions. Everybody has them. Twitter, Facebook, email, BlackBerry, your kids, your parents, your job. What are your distractions? How do you deal with them? Let us know. 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about distractions today. We've got lots of them around the studio. We've got the clock. We've got CNN on the TV, Femi making jokes about me. There's distractions everywhere. We all face them every day, not only in the studio. There's text messages. There's Facebook. There's tweets, BlackBerry, email. The list goes on. What distracts you the most?
I think we're all in danger of being on a short cell phone leash. My strategy is to choose a ringtone that is unobtrusive and mild enough so that it's actually easier to miss the call.
Oh, that's Troy from South Dakota. Tell us your stories at 1-877-8-MYTAKE. Give us your stories of distraction or focus at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Okay, Todd. Hurricanes have a way of getting your attention. And the Atlantic hurricane season starts June 1st, with forecasters predicting a near-normal hurricane season. Although, what does that mean? If you go by the numbers, a 70% chance of 4 to 7 hurricanes with 1 to 3 major ones. But what really is normal about a hurricane? For a closer-to-the-ground look, we're going to go down to New Orleans, checking in first with Mark Shelfstein. He's an environmental reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. All right, Mark, what is a near-normal hurricane season to you?
Well, that's pretty close to normal for what these kinds of statistics are showing. You know, an average year usually has about 11 named storms, 6 hurricanes, and 2 of those are major. Last year was an above normal season, and we had 16 named storms and 8 hurricanes, and 5 of those were major. So hopefully this will be a less normal hurricane year. But none of that really means anything.
You sound like you're taking these forecasts really seriously, and you're down there with a scorecard.
Exactly. Well, everybody has a scorecard beginning June 1st, and the reason for that is that they put these scorecards out to try to raise awareness for the public so that the public can start putting together their plans to do, you know, what they need to do when one of these hurricanes starts approaching land. And that's what's really important, is watching from June 1st on, and really in our area it would be from the beginning of August on, because that's when the more active season occurs, and being ready to do what's needed to be done. On the East Coast, that really is what you need to do, is keep an eye out and get ready to possibly move inland 5 to 10 miles to get away from the storm surge zone. Here it's a lot more difficult. You've got to make plans well in advance, because you might be away from home for several days.
Well, in fact, let's go and see what Terry Coleman's doing. He's a tugboat captain. He's been living in New Orleans for some 57 years. And if he's a tugboat captain, you know he's got to be keeping an eye on things. Hey, Terry, how much do you pay attention to these hurricane forecasts every year?
Well, actually, we pay attention quite a bit as a mariner. We monitor the forecast, as well as look at the temperature of the water and during the spring and also the early summer. Pretty much around July 4th, you could pretty much tell if the water temperature is increased quite a bit, then you could look for a severe hurricane season.
Terry, do forecasts like the ones coming out this week, do they affect your business at all? When the forecasts come out to shippers, fishing boats, tankers, whoever you deal with, do they change their plans at all in a way that affects your business, or is it more of a storm-by-storm kind of assessment?
Well, actually, when you get a forecast that such as we have this year, it's pretty much normal operations, because that is sound like a pretty normal year. However, if it increases for some reason, then we go into sort of like a mode of being cautious and doing more drills and having more communications among the plants and the oil refineries, just in case, you know, that something happens, that we have to do some extraordinary activity.
Hey, now, you lost your house in New Orleans East after Katrina. So I'm wondering, what impact does Katrina have on the way you prepare for hurricane seasons now?
Well, now we, as a community, do more communications, and we prepare ourselves by gathering supplies earlier. Instead of doing it at the last minute, you gradually start accumulating water, batteries, and supplies such as that.
So what's your go-to plan right now, Terry?
Well, right now, I plan on, if we have a severe hurricane, a major hurricane, I plan on evacuating to Atlanta primarily. I've started to talk to my friends and relatives up there and chatting with them just in case I have to be a house guest.
Okay. And that's for a major hurricane. And if we have something even worse than that?
Well, if we have something worse than that, then I plan to drive to Atlanta and possibly get on a plane to go to Vegas.
What are you going to do in Vegas? Gamble and hope for money for the next tugboat?
Well, what I plan on doing is just riding it out. You see, going to Atlanta, you could catch a plane out of Atlanta. It'd be difficult to catch one out of New Orleans during a hurricane.
Oh, so. True enough. Hey, Mark, I want to turn back to you at the Times-Picayune. Tell me how the rest of New Orleans is preparing for hurricane season this year. I mean, what if you're not able to fly to Vegas?
Well, that's a real serious problem throughout the area. The reality is that you've got to leave in advance of a major hurricane or even a moderate hurricane still after Katrina, because the levee system is still not built back up to where it should be. That won't be completed until the year 2011, maybe 2012, the way things are looking. We just heard yesterday that the Army Corps of Engineers is going to be late with one of their interim measures that was aimed at stopping one batch of storm surge that has the potential of coming into the city that actually almost flooded the city last year during Hurricane Gustav. They're trying to put this huge concrete barrier across one of the waterways, and that barrier won't be in the first part of that barrier won't be in place by this hurricane season, it turns out.
Now, let's hope that it's a mild one. That's Mark Schlefstein, environmental reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and Terry Coleman, a tugboat captain. Let's go to Femi Oke in the news.
Thank you. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. FDIC regulators have shut down Florida's largest regional bank. The closure of the bank, United FSB, is expected to cost the Fed $4.9 billion. Stormy Florida weather is keeping the space shuttle Atlantis from heading home today. The shuttle will remain in orbit an extra day and try to land at Cape Canaveral tomorrow. In international news, the UN is asking for more than $500 million in aid to help out Pakistani refugees. Tens of thousands of refugees are living in camps south of the Swat Valley, where much of the fighting has been taking place. That's a look at some news headlines making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with Catherine Lamfer in the studio. We're talking about distractions, tweets, Facebook, texting, BlackBerry, cell phones. What distracts you the most, and how do you deal with it?
The thing that distracts me most is my BlackBerry instant messaging on my phone. As I sit in my cubicle, passing time, my BBMing, my work piles up, and every day I don't know where the time went.
That was Elizabeth from New Jersey. Tell us your stories of distraction and focus at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Now, Todd, Vice President Joe Biden arrived earlier this morning in Lebanon, and he's just finished speaking. He's there to reinforce U.S. support for the pro-Western government there. He's meeting with Lebanese President Michel Suleiman in Beirut, where he's hoping to show support for that leader during a very tough election season for that pro-Western government we've been talking about. The Lebanese Shiite armed group Hezbollah is expected to make gains in the June 7th elections. And to find out more, we're going to go now to Rami Khoury. He's the director of the Issam Ferris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University in Beirut. He's also the editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper over there. Now, Rami, Vice President Biden's visit follows pretty close on the heels of Secretary of State Clinton's trip to Lebanon. Talk about what's at stake here for the Obama administration in these upcoming elections.
Well, the stakes are pretty high, and they're really quite regional. They go way beyond just Lebanon's borders. The previous administration of Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice had a very aggressive policy in Lebanon where they supported the government and used their support, military, economic, diplomatic, to explicitly and openly fight back politically against Hezbollah and its allies, including some of its Christian important allies like Michel Aoun, to fight back against these groups who the Americans accused of being agents of Syria and Iran. So Lebanon is, for the Americans, has been a microcosm of a regional ideological struggle. It seems like Obama and Clinton have kind of followed that same line, but a little bit softer, perhaps. But the Clinton coming here and now Biden showing support for the government, but really trying to focus a little bit more on talking about a free election and sovereign Lebanon, etc. So there may be very subtle little shifts in emphasis from the Obama administration, but I think the main message is that the United States still hasn't figured out how do you get involved in internal ideological struggles within the Arab world without making a complete mess of things.
Well, talk about the wiggle room they might need to leave, given that the polls show that Hezbollah could make large gains in this election.
Well, it's not, to be accurate, it's not Hezbollah as such. It's Hezbollah with Michel Aoun, who's the leading Christian leader, and other smaller groups. And the polls show that this alliance of different groups would likely get a very small majority if the elections were held today, but the elections are held in a couple of weeks and there is about 15% still undecided and all kinds of things can happen. But the U.S. clearly has to have a plan B. In case the Hezbollah-led alliance wins the majority and reforms the government, the U.S. would have to figure out what does it do. I think, to be fair to the Obama people, they've already made it reasonably clear that they're going not to make any rash decisions. They're not going to jump in and boycott the Lebanese government like they did the Palestinian Hamas-led government in Palestine. They're saying they're going to wait for the government's makeup and see what is the position of the government, what is the policy statement of the government. The U.S. is coming to terms with Iranian realities, with Syrian realities. It's revising its diplomatic position with Iran and Syria, and probably therefore would do something similar with a Lebanese government in which Hezbollah was a major player. And it is a player in this government, by the way. Hezbollah is a junior partner.
All right, Rami, you just brought up Syria. So what, I mean, Syria is really the key factor whenever you're talking about Lebanon, isn't it? Syria is the one key factor and Israel is the other. So do we know what message the vice president takes to Lebanon on Syria? Do we think that any meetings will take place if they're not in front of television cameras, perhaps back channel? How does the vice president go and deal with the Syrian question today?
Clearly, the Syrian issue is always a big one in Lebanon, and it tends to be a little bit behind the scenes these days since the Syrians left Lebanon in the spring of 2005 after the killing of former Prime Minister Hariri. The United States, again, is a little bit schizophrenic. It's recalibrating its policy to Syria. It sent important envoys to Syria, had talked with them. George Mitchell just asked for a visa to go to Damascus on his next trip. So it's trying to play footsies with the Syrians and reconnect, which is the intelligent, smart thing to do. At the same time, it keeps saying that it's sending messages for the Syrians to leave Lebanon alone, which is also a reasonable thing to do. But so there is a little bit of confusion, but the U.S. clearly is trying the diplomatic approach with both Syria and Iran. If they don't, if the U.S. doesn't feel that, that reasonable progress is made diplomatically, the problem for the U.S. is that it only has the option of going back to, you know, pressure and sanctions and threats, and those haven't worked. And that's why it's doing the diplomacy now, because the hardline approach hasn't worked. So the United States, I think, is in for a real dose of reality in terms of hardball politics in the Middle East, which the Obama people are probably addressing a little bit more intelligently than the Bush people.
Speaking of reality, talk about if Hezbollah does make these gains. I mean, they have some domestic pressures, obviously, going on as well. I was just reading about the houses that they had promised to people, houses that were lost in the last conflict with Israel that haven't been replaced yet. So I'm wondering that balance they have to keep up between their version of security and then their version of domestic help.
Right. I mean, the important thing about Hezbollah or Hamas or any of these Islamist militant resistance groups that also do politics, which they do, is that they're constantly balancing their role as a resistance movement that is fighting against Israeli occupation or annexation, which is clearly legitimate. Everybody in the world says you can fight against a foreign occupation. But they have to balance that with their role as domestic political actors. And incumbency breeds accountability. So if you're in the government, if you're sharing in the cabinet, if you're in parliament, people expect from you more than the rhetoric of resistance. They want you to deliver telephones and medical care and housing and education and jobs. So all of the groups in the region who are going through this transition are having to meet the same challenge, which is how do they translate the credibility, legitimacy, influence that they generated through military resistance, how do they translate that into successful governance that makes them legitimate and that keeps them, they are already legitimate, but that enhances their legitimacy in the eyes of their own people. It's a classic challenge that any, let's say, guerrilla movement has to meet when it transitions from military resistance to political governance.
Oh, Rami Khoury, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Rami Khoury, director of the Issam Ferris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut, talking to him about the upcoming elections in Lebanon. And, of course, if you have any comments yourself, 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. It does not get any better than that. The king of pop, regardless of what you think about his personal life. It just doesn't get any better than Billie Jean. Well, it has been it's been more than 12 years since Michael Jackson's performed on stage. And the king of pop says, quote, this is it for 50 consecutive nights in London coming this summer. He says, this is it. Now, I don't know if he means this is it, like this is the concert to see this summer.
How about please let this be it?
Okay. Excuse me. We're playing Billie Jean.
Yeah, sorry.
Withhold comments, please.
A moment
please.
Of respect.
Thank you for Billie Jean.
Whatever.
I don't. Is he saying this is it, this is the last time I'm ever going to appear on stage, or this is it, the concert you have to see this summer? Well, London is wondering the same thing, and Michael Jackson's 50 years old. He hasn't been showing up to some rehearsals. Some people think he might not make it through a grueling 50-night run, even though he is the king of pop. Well, we've got someone from London joining us to talk about it. Actually, from Liverpool, Chris Hawkins is a presenter on BBC Six Digital Music Radio. He's in a train station. He's been trying to get Michael Jackson tickets. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you, guys. Hi, Catherine. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
Yeah, it's more like, is this it, rather than this is it.
Okay, so is it?
Well, who knows? Already, so predictably, we thought this is going to be such a big event. 50 dates, that seems a little bit ambitious. And lo and behold, as the dates draw closer, the first few get postponed, then more dates get set back to 2010. All very predictable. I think this was not a big surprise.
Right, but 50 concerts, are they all sold out already?
They are all sold out. Yeah, I tried to get tickets. I got an early bird code. I registered. I wouldn't put myself down as a great big Michael Jackson fan, but like you said, Todd, that song Billie Jean is just a masterpiece, a musical masterpiece.
It is.
And so I think for me it's sort of a morbid curiosity to see what Michael Jackson would be like, having never seen him live before. It'd be my one and only chance to see him. So I registered, but the first tickets that I could get were for January 2010. And I thought to myself, do I now, almost a year ahead, want to pay £75 for one ticket to a gig that probably won't actually happen? And I think it's very unlikely that he'll do all 50 dates.
You think it's unlikely that that ticket would ever come to fruition in the first place? Let me ask you a question. If you knew that he was going to make that date, you'd pay £75 to see Michael Jackson, right?
I would. Really would. You know, reports here in the UK are saying, reports and rumours are saying that he'll only actually, Michael Jackson himself, will actually only play 12 minutes of any of the shows, and that there'll be so many dancers, lookalikes and everything else. It will be one big Michael Jackson extravaganza, but maybe as little as 12 minutes of Michael Jackson actually performing himself.
All right, Chris, I have to ask, I know it's a tough ticket, but how does the presenter of BBC Six digital music radio station not get a ticket for Michael Jackson? How does that work? Where's
your
clout, man?
Well, that's a very good question. Led Zeppelin did something similar last year when they did their big comeback shows. Now, slightly different league and a slightly different set of fans for Led Zeppelin to Michael Jackson. But in the same way, but even the biggest names, you're really big sort of Hollywood stars that were over here, were having to pay for their own tickets. It really is so unique. It's a one-off. This is a management masterpiece, if you like. It's a masterclass in how to manage a big event. This
All right, Chris.
It's not just about Michael Jackson performing. It's a one big stage-managed show.
All right, I'm getting the sense the Brits approach favoritism with these hot tickets a little differently than we do. Oh. There it is, Thriller. That's Michael Jackson. He's performing in England. 50 shows. Will he make it? Just listen to this. It almost doesn't matter.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, sitting in the studio with Todd Zwillick. One of the things we're talking about this morning, distractions. You know, those text messages, tweets, Facebook status updates. Maybe you've got a BlackBerry message coming in. What distracts you the most, and how do you deal with it? We'd like to hear your stories, your strategies for having a more focused life at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And now we've got Femi Okeh, who's always focused on the news.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. A new bill will add tens of billions of dollars to the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan, among other new spending. But it strips out money President Obama wants to close the Guantanamo Bay prison. The Senate passed the more than $91 billion war spending bill last night. Starting next year, the war in Afghanistan will overtake the cost of Iraq. The bill passed overwhelmingly. A final bill should be ready for the president to sign into law by next month. A different kind of bill becomes law later today. It restricts credit card companies' ability to ramp up interest rates. It also makes it harder for people under 21 to get credit cards. Credit card companies fought hard against the new rules. Analysts say they may try to make up lost profits by raising fees or actually getting rid of reward programs, even for cardholders with good payment histories. Mexico says that it has another of its most wanted drug barons in custody. Drug barons, that would be very interesting. Like to see those pictures.
Now there's a cartel.
Meanwhile, soldiers nabbed the cartel leader in the northern city of Monterrey. The Mexican government has deployed some 45,000 soldiers nationwide to battle drug gangs. Moving to sports, the road to the NBA Finals is getting shorter. Just four teams are left in the Western Conference. Last night, the Denver Nuggets edged out the LA Lakers 106-103. And Nuggets forward Carmelo Anthony says that he's proud the team bounced back after losing Game 1.
Our team is so much mentally tougher than we was last year. And for us to fight back from that Game 1 that we gave away, But I just go to say a lot about our team.
The Nuggets and Lakers are now tied 1-1 in the best-of-seven series. And meanwhile, Game 2 of the Eastern Conference Championships is tonight. The Orlando Magic take on the Cleveland Cavaliers. Orlando leads the series 1-0. And that's a look at your news from around the world and in the United States. Todd Catherine.
All right, thank you, Femi. Well, four men accused of planning a terror attack on two synagogues in the Bronx and on military planes on a nearby Air Force base in New York were arraigned in federal court in upstate New York yesterday. They had been under investigation by the FBI, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and by the New York City Police Department. Here's NYPD Police Commissioner Ray Kelly briefing reporters on what he knew of the case yesterday.
They did make statements about what's going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that Muslims were being killed and that they were looking to do something against the United States.
Okay, well, in federal court in White Plains in Westchester yesterday, Assistant U.S. Attorney Eric Snyder said the suspects were, quote, eager to bring death to Jews. He also said the suspects said they were disappointed that the best target, which is the World Trade Center, was hit already. Well, according to our next guest, the NYPD likely played a big role in this investigation and has been working hard for several years to sharpen its approach to uncovering homegrown terrorist plots like the one we're talking about. Joining us is Lydia Khalil. She served as a counterterrorism expert and analyst for the NYPD from 2006 to 2008, and she's an international affairs fellow now at the Council on Foreign Relations. Lydia, to start off, a lot of people still might not be aware that the NYPD has its own counterterrorism and counterterrorism intelligence unit. Just bring us up to speed on this. What is this unit and what does it do for New York City?
Sure. Good morning. The New York Police Department has a counterterrorism bureau, and within that bureau there are two main divisions. One is the counterterrorism division and the other is the intelligence division. And they work together very closely on countering the terrorism threat in the New York area and also monitoring events overseas in case that they do manifest themselves here in our city.
Monitoring events overseas. The city of New York sends operatives, agents, what have you, to other countries. It's fascinating.
Well, they're more like liaison officers. And yes, I think we have about, I want to say anywhere between 12 to 18 NYPD liaison officers in various capitals throughout the world.
All right. And so they were apparently active in the plot, the alleged plot that we're talking about here in New York City, in the Bronx, in Riverdale this morning. So I want to ask you about this plot specifically. We're reading in the New York Times, of course, a little bit of a more of a window into the alleged plotters. And the crew of people that we're talking about, a crack addict, a person who's mentally ill, somebody with a long record as a petty thief, were these people asked this question after a lot of these homegrown plots are cracked? Are these people capable of carrying off a large-scale terrorist attack, or is it a lot of news coverage of for lack of a better word, some hapless clowns?
Well, as far as we know from the information we have, these guys don't have an overseas connection. They may be hapless, they may be incompetent, and I think there was one quote in the paper that says these guys aren't exactly al-Qaeda. Well, these guys aren't at all al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. but at the same time, that doesn't make them any less dangerous. They could get lucky. One of the guys, I think it was the ringleader of the attack, had been caught on tape saying, I'd like to shoot all these people as he was scoping out the synagogue, so people walking in front. While they may not have been able to get explosives or a Stinger missile on their own, they could have easily got a handgun and carried out that type of attack. So these guys do come off as a bunch of clowns, petty criminals, like I said, they could get lucky. You just never know.
And this entire plot sort of developed really under the auspices of the NYPD and the FBI, didn't it? I mean, it seems like certainly the bombs they got were fake, the missile launchers they got were fake. They were under the watch of the FBI and dealing with an informant. Do we have any sense, is it possible to have any sense of how dangerous these fellows really could have been if they weren't acting on a stage-managed play managed by the FBI?
Well, I think the NYPD and the FBI are very aware about the issue of entrapment. So I'm
right.
assuming that they got their informer in early and they were lucky enough to do that. But probably they were very careful not to have the informant egg them on or say anything, just because if they did, it's going to come out in the trial.
Right.
So I don't know if I would quite put it as a stage managed play, but that's certainly something that the law enforcement agencies do have to be aware of.
Okay.
And, you know, who knows with these guys? They could, like I said, they could get lucky. Just because they may be incompetent doesn't mean something couldn't have happened. I mean, I think that's one of the things that people need to be aware of. We shouldn't exaggerate the threat coming from homegrown groups, especially in the United States, because we're lucky enough to have a better assimilation policy than other parts of the world, but it's something to be aware of. And the New York Police Department's been, like you mentioned it earlier, been doing a study, I think starting since 2007, on this homegrown threat.
Well, I had one question about the NYPD and their counterterrorism and their intelligence that struck me. We're talking a lot today about national security strategy in Washington, detainees, classified information. When a city has a counterterrorism unit and deals with a lot of secret stuff, what are the rules for classified information? We hear a lot about, you know, state secrets and the rules with the CIA and the Pentagon and the stuff in Washington. When you're local, what's classification? Can the mayor declare a city secret that nobody can know about it based on city security?
That's a really good question. Technically and legally speaking, the New York Police Department or local authorities cannot classify something. So the classification system that the federal government use, confidential, secret, top secret, and SCI, those are strictly federal classifications on intelligence issues. So while law enforcement evidence and information is classified as sensitive or law enforcement sensitive, it's not strictly classified. That being said, the New York Police Department has worked long and hard with the FBI in terms of getting some of its detectives and analysts who work on the terrorism issue clearances. Mm-hmm. And this has kind of been an ongoing effort, and many of them do have clearances. Certainly not everybody within the New York Police Department does. I mean, it's a 37,000-strong organization. It's only those handful of people who work on terrorism issues are able to get federal clearances in order to have access to information that the federal government has to help them secure New York City.
We'll be following this case as it heads into the courts again. Four alleged plotters in the Bronx accused of planning a terror attack on two synagogues in the Bronx and a nearby Air Force base. Lydia Khalil, former counterterrorism analyst for the NYPD and now at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you for joining us.
You know, Todd, we've been asking everyone for their distractions. Listen to Doug from New Jersey.
The thing that distracts me most would have to be my libido. How I deal with it is I just give in and contemplate for a few minutes and then bring myself back to reality.
So, what distracts you? Give us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And remember, if you've missed anything, we're always here on The Takeaway. Get our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And here is your takeaway.
It's not just his legacy that he's trying to protect, although that's clearly part of it, but it's an ideology that he's trying to protect. You know, he believes in a strong executive. He believes in this wartime president that has sort of unfettered power, and he's going to fight for that.
That's Jake Bernstein. He is a reporter for ProPublica and the co-author of the Cheney biography, Vice. He was talking to us about the former vice president's views on the interrogation tactics he implemented under the Bush administration.
I'm Todd Zwillick. You can follow my Twitter feed, by the way. You can find it on thetakeaway.org. Follow me in Washington. Love to have you.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
To keep up with the world, we've got 24/7 news. We text. We instant message. But with all this keeping up, how much of life is getting away? Todd?
Catherine, just hang on one sec. One sec. I just got to finish this tweet. One sec. Oh, there we go.
Hey, America. Here's a status update. Pay attention. It's the Focus Life. It's the Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 22nd. John Hockenberry is away. I'm Catherine Lanfer here in the studio with Todd Zwillick. Hey, Todd.
Good morning, Catherine. Coming up this hour, fine art missing in action in Vietnam. It's a war story you've never heard. Plus political geometry. We'll talk about what President Obama can do with a triangulation strategy. We'll bring you those stories and plenty more, but first we've got your top headlines.
This afternoon, the president signs a bill that will change the plastic in your wallet. The bill restricts companies' abilities to amp up interest rates. It also makes it harder for people under 21 to get cards. Card companies fought hard against these new rules, and analysts say they may try to make up lost profits by raising fees or ditching reward programs, even for cardholders with clean credit. Before he signs the bill, the president has another graduation speech to give. Later this morning, he speaks at a commencement ceremony at the U.S. Naval Academy. Among the graduates, John Sidney McCain IV. You may have heard of his father, Senator John McCain. He's also a Naval Academy grad. Had the election results been reversed, Naval Academy grad McCain might have been the featured speaker.
Wasn't to be. Space Shuttle Atlantis astronauts will be up there for another day. Bad weather in Florida forced NASA to scrub today's possible landings. It's now scheduled to touch down Saturday morning. The shuttle has enough supplies to stay up until Monday. If Florida weather stays gloomy, there's a backup landing site in California. An American journalist held captive in Iran is headed back to the U.S. The U.S. State Department says Roxana Saberi is flying home today. Iran held her prisoner for weeks, convicting her of spying and charges and landing her in a shady jail. She was freed earlier this month and spent a week in Austria recuperating.
Looking overseas, the U.N. wants more than $500 million to help refugees fleeing the war in Pakistan. The Pakistani army is in a tough fight with Taliban militants in the Swat Valley and elsewhere. The government estimates nearly 2 million people have fled the violence since the latest offensive, and the United Nations is starting a fundraising appeal today.
A new bill will add tens of billions of dollars to the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan, among other new spending. But it strips out money President Obama wanted to close Guantanamo Bay. The Senate passed the more than $91 billion war bill last night. Starting next year, the war in Afghanistan will overtake the cost of Iraq.
The president will be at Camp David this weekend. You can't join him there, but about 1 in 10 Americans will take a Memorial Day trip. That's AAA's estimate for weekend travel. Gas prices, by the way, are rising again, and energy analysts say there's little chance that they'll get anywhere near last summer's prices. The S&P and the Dow each lost more than 1.5%. The S&P is at 888. The Dow will start trading at 8292. We're talking about distractions, Facebook, tweets, texts. You tell us what distracts you. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm sitting here with Catherine Lamfer. Well, we heard former Vice President Dick Cheney in full attack mode yesterday in Washington.
Half measures keep you half exposed. You cannot keep just some nuclear-armed terrorist out of the United States. You must keep every nuclear-armed terrorist out of the United States.
Okay, well, President Obama seems to be taking it from all sides. He's got the former Vice President Dick Cheney hitting him from the right. He's got liberals hitting him from the left on detainees and Truth Commission, which leaves the president smack in the middle. Well, that sounds like he's getting hit a lot, but maybe that's right where the president wants to be. Maybe he's positioned right where he thinks he should be. Former President Bill Clinton called this tactic triangulation. And now in the New York Times, Peter Baker, who's a reporter there, writes, quote, President Obama seems to be turning to a triangulation strategy of his own. Peter Baker is with us. He's White House correspondent at the Times, and he's joining us. Peter, triangulation, of course, is the famous Clinton strategy. We just described it, leveraging two political positions at once and landing smack dab in the middle. How is the vice president applying this charge to the current president?
Well, what he says, what Dick Cheney says, is that, of course, triangulation is a political strategy, not a national security strategy, and that trying to play both sides off the other in a way, which is maybe successful in a political context, isn't the way to protect the country. It's a very interesting, you know, moment for Obama. This is really the first time he's been on the defensive on a matter of policy since he's taken office. And he's really trying to find a way of weaving between a lot of different, you know, competing and emotional, outpost in the American society right now. He's trying to say, I'm going to keep you safe, but at the same time, I'm going to, modify, but not get rid of, the whole Bush architecture on fighting terrorism. And that's a tough argument because people feel very strongly one way or the other.
Right, and it seems like in Washington, every time a bomb gets thrown, for instance, on Capitol Hill, Republican leaders...
Metaphorically, let's say.
Right, metaphorically. Every time a metaphorical, rhetorical bomb gets thrown at the president on detainees from the right, and then somebody like a liberal, like maybe Chairman Patrick Leahy of Judiciary, comes out about for truth commissions or prosecuting Bush administration lawyers for detainee policy and torture, it always seems like Barack Obama's the most reasonable guy in the room.
Well, that's the way he wants you to feel about it, absolutely. And he is trying to explain a nuanced position and trying to explain it in a understandable way. It's a real challenge, but he has, it's interesting about Obama. He has supreme confidence in his own ability to explain any position to the American people. That's been, of course, one of his political strengths, his speaking ability. And we've seen that actually several times in the last week alone, in which he's been caught up in some sort of controversy, and his decision to sort of take it head on out of the sort of self-confidence that if he simply explains to people, they'll get it. And that's his idea.
All right. Well, Peter, I want you to listen to another statement from the former vice president yesterday, because I think Dick Cheney agrees with you on triangulation. Listen to this.
The administration seems to pride itself on searching for some kind of middle ground in policies addressing terrorism. They may take comfort in hearing disagreement from opposite ends of the spectrum. If liberals are unhappy about some decisions and conservatives are unhappy about other decisions, then it may seem to them that the president is on the path of sensible compromise. But in the fight against terrorism, there is no middle ground.
All right. The former vice president, as we say, quote, gets it. He gets it on triangulation, but he seems to be frustrated by it.
Right. Well, Obama, of course, is saying, I don't believe in absolutists, and there are these absolutists on the one side who say that, terrorism doesn't justify any change or any compromise at all in the way we've done things in the past, and there are absolutists on the other side who believe nothing matters except, defending against terrorism and forget any other priorities. And what Obama's trying to say is, I reject both those ideas, and I'm trying to find a pragmatic middle. And what Cheney is essentially saying, it's the old Barry Goldwater formulation to some extent. He's saying absolutism in the defense of liberty is no vice. He's saying that there's nothing wrong, and in fact a great deal right with understanding that to protect the country you're going to have to make some sacrifices, and that's what is needed at this time.
How ironic and how frustrating must it be for former Vice President Cheney to realize that it's his very absolutism that helps President Obama with this triangulation strategy.
Well, that's probably right. That's probably right. I mean, what you really heard yesterday, it was really fascinating to think about it. What you heard were, you heard two different viewpoints, right? You heard the 2001 viewpoint and you heard the 2009 viewpoint. And what Cheney is reflecting is the view of somebody who lived through 9/11 in that White House bunker, making these decisions, having to live with the consequences, and feeling responsible in a very powerful way for protecting the country at a time when everybody thought that what happened on 9/11 was going to be repeated. And what Obama is coming at it from is a point of view 8 years later, when we haven't been hit inside the country since then, and the sort of the fear of the moment is kind of dissipated, and sort of the shock of that moment is dissipated, and he's looking at it in a different way with a different balance.
But Peter, hang on a minute, though, because if you look at the text and if you listen to President Obama yesterday, I think you could argue that you also heard someone who was very impassioned saying, look, what this country is about the rule of law, and by straying from that, we are actually making life more dangerous for ourselves. I mean, I heard an equally impassioned argument about a different way to defend our country, not so much someone saying, well, the danger, it's been a while since we've been hit.
No, I'm not saying he's in any way minimizing the danger, but I am saying he's living in an environment in which the danger is not the dominant feeling in American society right now. In 2001 and in 2002, you did not hear a lot of voices at that time talking about the civil liberties part of the natural tension between security and liberty. You had people always all talking and focusing on the security aspect of things, and that justified a lot of ideas. And what Obama is saying is, okay, that period is gone. Whatever happened back then is gone. We're in an environment now where we can measure these things and recognize that we have the different values that we still have to uphold. That's what he's saying.
All right. Well, Peter, one of the key issues on this is interrogation, certainly enhanced interrogation, waterboarding, torture. Another key issue is detainees in Guantanamo, whether Guantanamo will be closed. And that's another key part of national security strategy. It came up in both speeches yesterday. But in terms of the president being in the middle, he's not alone. There are conservative Republicans who seem to want to be joining him, I guess, if he truly is in the middle on finding a way forward on detainees. He's not just getting help from Democrats. Listen to Lindsey Graham, conservative senator from South Carolina.
I want a system that will be there for the next president and the ones thereafter. And I talked to the president yesterday. He called me yesterday, and he says, we're going to go down on the middle on this. We're going to find a system that repairs damage and moves forward. And he wants a system, and he said this, that my predecessor will be able to use.
That's from an interview I had with the senator the other day on Capitol Hill. He's also saying that the president's going to work with me on this, and I'm going to help him with the politics.
Sure, right. Well, listen, that's what's interesting about Obama's approach here. It's sort of a smorgasbord approach in some ways. He's picking on different topics, something here that the left likes, something here that the right likes. Lindsey Graham is supportive of that idea. He's not supportive of some of the other things that Obama's talked about. For instance, I think Lindsey Graham has been critical of the idea of accountability for anybody who devised policies on torture, enhanced interrogation techniques, that sort of thing. And that's what's interesting about Obama's approach. Different people are supporting different aspects of it and then critical of other aspects of it.
All right. Well, we've been talking about the politics of this and where the president has positioned himself, and that's interesting. But it seems like the real proof of this is going to be in events, isn't it? If we go another 4 years, 8 years without an attack, the president will be proved right. We can enhance our rule of law and still have security. And if we're attacked, he'll be proved wrong in public opinion, won't he?
Well, I mean, that will be the argument anyway. You can make an argument about whether or not an attack proves we were right or wrong. Certainly Bush makes the argument that we went 7 years without an attack after 9/11 inside the United States, and therefore that justifies what he did, and it shows he was right, blah, blah, blah. You know, we don't really know why we weren't hit in the last 7 years, and if we were hit in the next 4 years, we won't necessarily know whether it's a result of a particular policy change. But certainly that will be the argument people will make. That will certainly be the context in which anything happens. And that's something Obama people are very conscious of. I mean, they don't want to do anything that would, you know, give credence to the argument that they have done anything to weaken the nation's defenses on the chance that something happens, and something could happen irregardless of everything that's done to stop it. You know, as the Bush people always used to say, and they're right about this, you know, the terrorist only has to be successful one time. We have to be successful 100% of the time.
And if they're not successful 100% of the time, the Democratic administration has to find a strategy to convince the public they were still doing the right thing, or at least trying to. Thanks, Peter. That was Peter Baker, White House correspondent for our partners, The New York Times, talking about the politics of detainee strategy and the way forward and the president's triangulation on the war on terror.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. We've been talking about distractions today, Catherine. Catherine?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
Making sure you're paying attention.
Yeah.
We all face distractions every day. Facebook, tweets, BlackBerry, the list goes on. What about family?
My major distraction is my two very young children. I find that they barely can finish a sentence, let alone have a conversation. I'm sure a lot of parents will relate to that.
That's Fatima Dutch, who has to deal with the distractions of her young children. Later this hour, we'll talk to an author whose latest book looks at the science behind how we pay attention, or don't. But first, we want to know what distracts you the most, and what's your strategy for staying focused with all these distractions out here? Tell us your stories at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
All right, Todd. Oh, there we go. Oh. I guess that's another distraction. Are we done yet? Focus, people. Now, listen to this. There was a plan to protect art at one point in Vietnam, not lose it, with hopes of saving the art treasures of Vietnam during the war. But the Museum of Fine Arts in Hanoi is now finding that it's holding on to copies. There's some speculation about what has actually happened to the original works of art. We're going to go now to the BBC's arts reporter, Lawrence Pillard. He's been watching this story. Lawrence, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi there. Nice to talk to you.
Now, what exactly is going on in Hanoi? How did the loss of these works of art come about?
Well, what's interesting is that you remember, for example, kind of the time of the invasion of Baghdad as well, and all the problems with the museum there. Before any conflict, there's a big amount of military planning that's going on. But also, there are sort of, you know, less important people, less important you kind of think, but actually it becomes more important when it comes along, because you're talking about culture, who have to think, well, what are you going to do with culture? I'm speaking to you from London. Here in London during the Second World War, the British hid their National Gallery in slate mines, actually, in Wales, right? So it all gets crated up and it goes off. Now, when the Vietnamese were threatened, as they were, with being possibly bombed back into the Stone Age, they thought, okay, we'd better put our culture under wraps. Okay, so they binned up all their stuff, put it in caves in the jungle. But then the communist authorities thought, that's a bit of a propaganda defeat. You know, we don't want to be seen to be kneeling before the Yankee. We want to actually have our museum open. And so they told the director, really sorry, you've got to protect all the culture, but we still want to keep the museum open. Bit of a problem. So they got round it brilliantly by asking living artists to paint copies of the paintings that were being put in the jungles. But and if they couldn't find a living artist, they got their restoration people to do a copy. And they put all the copies on the wall.
Within the art tradition of Vietnam, isn't there a sort of respect for copies, and it isn't necessarily
in
value?
No, that's very true. But bear in mind that a lot of these artists had been trained at the École des Beaux-Arts, as it was called, under the French Empire, the French colonial. So they'd been, you know, I went to an exhibition here in London, actually, recently, of Vietnamese art, and a lot of it was kind of, you know, very sort of agitprop stuff. But it's not painted like Soviet art. Quite a lot of this stuff was painted like a Renoir. So it looked like a really politically angry impressionist, if you can imagine anything that strange. But what happened, unfortunately, and the reason for this, for the reason this problem is that you get a museum of copies, you get all the real stuff hidden in the jungle. Then everyone sort of forgets which is which, precisely because it doesn't actually matter that much to them. You make an absolutely right point, Catherine. You know, there are different ideas of authenticity and individual expression. And so if there are two versions of a painting, well, there's just two versions of the painting. The problem arises when you want to start selling this stuff, right? Because if you want a market, just like you want a housing market or a financial market or a derivatives market.
Who's selling it, though?
There's a kind of, you know, there is a world market. People will buy stuff that they think either is pretty or, to be perfectly honest, more often they will think, that's a good investment. So people start looking at sort of, you know, minority art worlds like Vietnamese art. And slowly, slowly, it has emerged. Some of the real stuff has been stolen, or rather has been sold quietly. And in fact, the story emerged because the son of a great Vietnamese painter was looking at a catalogue of a Russian museum and saw a painting by his dad, went to his dad, said, Dad, is this by you? And his dad says, yes, it is actually, but I thought it was hanging in Hanoi. And it turns out that it was hanging in Hanoi and in Moscow. And there's the same situation with paintings that have ended up in Singapore, that have ended up in Japan. Absolutely bizarre. But you see, the reason that it becomes a crisis is because the art market wants a reliable market. They want paintings that they can say, this is by such and such a man, done at such and such a time, it's worth such and such amount of money. You see what I'm saying? So you kind of, it's the market that's complaining about it, the art market. And so they've gone back to the gallery, and the gallery, in effect, this obviously isn't a quote, said, yes, we were wondering when someone would find out about this. And it's kind of emerged. But your point about different, you know, what people are really interested in is absolutely true. It's not a scandal in Vietnam like it would be a scandal in America or in Britain. It's just different attitudes. But it's an interesting little historical sidelight on this sort of little bit of cultural history. Really.
And we think at this point maybe half of the paintings that are up on the walls from the Museum of Fine Arts or copies?
Indeed, there is a professor at the Art Institute of Chicago who has studied this and who told the BBC, told us here, that, yes, she estimated at least half of the stuff that that is on the museums of the Institute of Fine Art in Hanoi will be the copies. And, now, you see, notice that I don't say fake there. I say copies. There's a bit of a subtle difference. You've got the original, a copy, and then an outright fake.
Oh, for all of these fine art distinctions, we thank you for your time. Lawrence Pollard, BBC Arts correspondent. He joined us from London. Joining us from the newsroom is our own Femi Oke.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The Senate has passed a bill granting President Obama's request for more than $90 billion to fund military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. They left out funding requested by the president to close the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. It's a busy Friday for President Obama. He started the morning just a few minutes ago by signing a key bill into law. The bill tightens control over how the Pentagon buys weapons. And later today, the president will sign the credit card bill. It's aimed at protecting consumers and stops credit cards from imposing arbitrary interest rate increases and penalties. So it is Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial start of summer. Now, despite the struggling economy, AAA estimates that more than 30 million people will be travelling this weekend. That's about 1 in 10 Americans. That's slightly up from last year.
It makes you want to stay home.
Right, Catherine, it's going to be quite a nice weekend. Meanwhile, we head to New Zealand for international news, where the Quinlan family have been teaching their three-year-old daughter, Peppy, how to navigate the internet. This week, they were shocked to get a message. Here's mum, Sarah Quinlan.
We got up to find a success email that I had won an auction that I hadn't bid on. That was where the question started.
So the Quinlans found that they had actually bought a bulldozer. It was about to be delivered to them, and it was ordered on the online website by their little girl, Peppy. Now, they had left their computer on overnight. She had remembered her internet lessons earlier and clicked and clicked and clicked until she'd ordered the bulldozer. Fortunately, the seller let them off from paying up. And finally to Mexico, where the mayor of Mexico City says there's been no new infections of the H1N1 or swine flu virus and that the citizens there can relax. Mexico City has lowered its alert from yellow to green, so there's no fear of any contagion. That's according to the mayor of Mexico. That's a look at your news from around the world and from here in the US. Thanks.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here in the studio with Catherine Lamfer, and it's time to drop in on the healthcare debate. It's just starting to really heat up in Washington, and as soon as Congress comes back in early June after the holiday, you're going to hear a lot about your healthcare, your costs, and your premiums. Listen to this campaign ad first from President Obama back when he was a candidate.
But here's what he's not telling you. McCain would make you pay income tax on your health insurance benefits, taxing health benefits for the first time ever.
Well, not so fast. 50 million of us have no health insurance at all, but 160 million of us do, and we get it through our employers tax-free. If you want to reform health care, you have to raise the money, and guess what? Democrats are in control, and taxing insurance benefits may be exactly what they're planning to do. Well, joining us to talk about it is Princeton University professor Uwe Reinhardt. He's an expert on health policy. He's one of the nation's foremost health economists, and he's advising the president on the upcoming health reform debate. He's got a blog in the economics blog today in the New York Times where he makes the case that employment-based health insurance, which is what most of us have, by far what most of us have, is deeply flawed. We should consider getting rid of it. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Hi, Professor. What's the origin, first, of employment-based health insurance? You say it's a relic.
Yes, it's a relic that dates back to World War II, at
which time Congress imposed wage controls on the folks who made the ammunition, and, however, with its usual tactic, left open a loophole by saying fringe benefits are not part of wages, and therefore fringe benefits started to mushroom as companies were using fringes to attract workers. It's okay. Just an accident.
An accident, but these days, 160 million of us or more get our health insurance through our employers. The vast majority of us, 80%, I guess, according to the polls, like it. So what's wrong with it? Why? What is it doing to the system that you don't like?
Well, there's several things wrong. The first one, of course, is that when you lose your job, you also lose your health insurance. That's bizarre. No other country in the world has this kind of arrangement. Secondly, though, it seems to fool everyone except, I guess, economists. I hate to be this arrogant. But workers think that this is a gift to them from the company, maybe the shareholders. But in fact, economists are convinced, both by theory but also empirical research, that it really in the long run comes out of the take-home pay of the workers. The higher healthcare costs rise, the lower is the take-home pay, and there's evidence, plenty of that. So actually, workers really pay for it, but they think it's a free gift. And therefore, they resist any attempt at cost containment. Cost containment would actually help them having a bigger paycheck, but in fact, they think it just makes shareholders fat.
So people resist attempts to get rid of this because they're comfortable with it, and now you're sort of talking about the politics, because as this debate comes up, now all of a sudden, after the campaign and the president said, well, Senator McCain wants to tax your health benefits, Democrats are talking about doing exactly that. The way they might try to reduce reliance on employer-sponsored health care is to start to tax it. How would that work?
Well, actually, it's not that wouldn't be the purpose. They're fishing
around. But it would be the effect, though.
The effect, yeah. The purpose is just a desperate struggle to find money to finance covering the uninsured. If you wanted to have universal coverage next year, you'd probably be talking about $150 billion in additional federal subsidies. The money isn't there. So the taxes that are not being paid because the contributions that employers make to health insurance are not taxable income, that's about $250 billion a year that the federal government is not collecting in taxes. So people are saying, don't tax all of it, but you could begin to nibble at it, say maybe of that $250 billion, you harvest maybe $70 billion towards covering the uninsured. And there are several ways you could do it.
Maybe taxing wealthier people or so-called Cadillac plans that cost a lot of money, right?
Yeah, you could say any contribution above $10,000 will be taxable. That's one way to do it. Or the other is to say, well, if you make less than $75,000, we won't tax it. But if you make more than $200,000, we'll treat all of it as taxable income. None of them will be popular.
None of them will be popular. Well, Professor, I want you to react to something, because even if they only tax part of it, looks like the health care system is going to have to change if we're going to spread insurance to 50 million people who don't have it. Listen to something that the president said just a couple of weeks ago when he was talking about the health care system.
I think most of us would agree that if we want to cover all Americans, we can't make the mistake of trying to fix what isn't broken. So if somebody has insurance they like, they should be able to keep that insurance.
The president says over and over, Professor, that if you like what you have, you can keep it. But just really quickly, is that really possible? 5 years out, 10 years out, when we've changed the system, a lot of people's health insurance is going to change, isn't it, whether they like it or not?
Yes, a lot of it will change. A lot of companies will get out of it. And he basically says, we're not going to force you to give up your employer-provided insurance. But what he may not be telling you is, that system may change in a way that you may want to get out of it and into an individually purchased product. If he can reorganize the market for individually purchased insurance, and that's really what he has to do. If he doesn't do that, then essentially he would have failed at health reform.
Professor Uwe Reinhardt, that's something to think about as we watch this healthcare debate. If promises can be kept. Princeton University's Professor Uwe Reinhardt, health economist, advisor to the president, one of the foremost voices on health economics, joining us to talk about the future of health policy and the upcoming debate. Well, Femi's here. She's in from the News Hub, and she has the headlines.
Thank you very much. The headlines coming to you at 22 minutes to the top of the hour. The Senate has passed a bill granting President Obama's request for more than $90 billion to fund military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. They left out funding requested by the president to close the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. The Space Shuttle Atlantis astronauts will be in orbit another day. Bad weather in Florida has forced NASA to scrub today's planned landing. It's now scheduled to touch down on Saturday morning. Now, the shuttle has enough supplies to stay up until Monday. And if Florida weather continues to look gloomy, there's a backup landing site in California. The United Nations is asking the international community for more than $500 million in aid to help out Pakistani refugees. Tens of thousands of them are living in camps south of the Swat Valley, where much of the fighting is taking place. Indonesia has made a ruling on the use of Facebook. Devout Muslims are now allowed to be friends on Facebook, but they're not allowed to flirt or gossip. There was some talk from conservative clerics that there would be a total ban on the social networking site, but the clerics haven't done that. They said it helps families to stay in touch. Meanwhile, while we're talking about social networking, Pope Benedict has entered the world of social networking. There's now a Vatican portal that you can upload to Facebook or on iPhone, and it gives surfers video and audio news on his travels and speeches, as well as an update on Catholic events worldwide. I'm sure any minute now you'll be able to Twitter the Pope. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Billy.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer. Today is the 150th anniversary of the birth of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the British writer who gave us Detective Sherlock Holmes. Here is Holmes with his trusted friend, Dr. Watson.
I'm blessed if I know why on earth you want all these clippings about this Baskerville fellow.
I have an idea, Watson, that young Sir Henry isn't destined for a very long existence in this world.
What?
My conjecture is that he'll be murdered.
Murdered?
It'll be very interesting to see if my deductions are accurate.
It'll be very interesting if you have a chance soon to see that 1939 version of The Hound of the Baskervilles with Basil Rathbone as Holmes and Nigel Bruce as Dr. Watson. You know, a new film reincarnation with Robert Downey Jr. as Holmes and Jude Law as Watson is due out at the end of the year. But for now, while we're waiting for that, we're going to take a look at the enduring legacy of Conan Doyle's most famous character with Charles Zepka. He is a professor of English at Boston University who studies detective fiction, and he is a co-editor of the Blackwell Companion to Crime Fiction. Oh, it's so hard to avoid every Sherlock Holmesian cliché. It's elementary, Professor. Please explain why we love Sherlock Holmes so much.
Well, good morning, Catherine, and thanks for having me on your show. I think one of the things that appeals to us even now about Sherlock Holmes is that he has the, if you will, he understands the method of understanding the world that we live in. And he also doesn't let himself be distracted by any ordinary human qualities that get in the way of our own abilities or attempts to make that to make those deductions that help us navigate a very confusing world.
Well, you know, talk about why he was so popular in Conan Doyle's time and why he's so popular now. What connection is there?
Well, we often think of the Holmes stories as set in a kind of gaslight Victorian era that is securely or well in the past, and we get very nostalgic about those foggy streets and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I really think that the Holmes stories were popular because they appeared at a crucial moment in the history of the West and of the British Empire in particular, which was beginning to fall apart, and it was very much in decline. He appears at the beginning of what a lot of scholars would call modernity, that is, the growing feeling that the Enlightenment project of creating an ever better world for all of us and endless progress towards achieving a kind of future utopia, that aim and ambition is now being compromised by all of these centrifugal forces pulling society and culture apart. And Holmes appears right at this moment as the man who has the answers. He's our first, in fact, he's our first private professional detective in the history of detective fiction. And before him, we had basically amateurs who were interested, like Edgar Allan Poe's Auguste Dupin, or we had police detectives. We didn't have private professionals. In other words, citizens like the rest of us who, through hard work and supreme intelligence, managed to make a career for themselves of figuring out the world around
Professor
us.
Professor Szepka, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but we know that you join us in wishing Sir Arthur Conan Doyle a happy birthday.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here in the studio with Catherine Lamper, and we've been talking about distractions today. We all face them every day here in the studio, certainly, but outside world, text messages, Facebook, Blackberries, tweets, instant message, tweets. That's distracting. That's what distracts you the most? You can tell what distracts us in the studio. It's pretty obvious. It's producers and directors. But what distracts you, and how do you deal with it? Tell us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE. Or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You might also want to tell us how you ignore distractions or annoying people. 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi is here with the headlines.
And not so annoying. Not annoying at all.
Oh, thank you. You stressed that a little too much, Catherine.
Okay.
12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. So the latest failed bank is the second largest to fall in the current crisis. The FDIC seized the Florida-based bank United FSB. And this bank had about $13 billion in assets. A group of private investors is buying it. An American journalist held captive in Iran is heading back to the United States. The State Department says that Roxana Shabari is flying home today. Iran held her prisoner for weeks, convicting her of spying charges. And she was freed earlier this month and spent a week in Austria recuperating. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair Mike Mullen says that it's possible that Taliban militants could move further into Pakistan. He told the Senate that it's a risk that if there's greater success against the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Pakistan faces many complex challenges. Perceived threats from the north and east, the very real threat of insurgency from within, and the growing risks of poverty and illiteracy unchecked.
Chairman Mullen says the U.S. is making plans to prevent that, although he didn't go into details. And happy Memorial Day weekend to you all. Here's a little factoid for you. AAA estimates that more than 30 million people will be travelling this weekend. If you're one of them, good luck. I'm staying at home. Let's look at your news for now. Todd, Catherine.
Thank you, Femi. You know, let's just hope none of those drivers are texting. In a world of texts, tweets, and blogs, what hope is there for the focus life? Well, plenty, says science writer Winifred Gallagher. She has a new book that delves into the science of how we pay attention. The book is called Rapt: Attention and the Focus Life, and she's found plenty of news that's worth, yes, paying attention to. She joins us here in the studio. Thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
Let's talk for a moment about the events in your life that forced you to focus on why we should be focusing on different things in life.
Okay. About 5 years ago, I came down very suddenly with a rather advanced case of breast cancer. And with a very uncertain prognosis. Very unusually for me, within maybe 10 minutes, I had a very clear insight that this negative event, as psychologists would call it,
wanted to monopolize all of my attention, and one of my coping strategies would be to do what I needed to do to deal with the disease, but to basically concentrate on pushing forward with my life, finishing the book I was writing, taking care of my five kids, Christmas shopping, yoga, the whole bit.
We were just checking to see if you were paying attention. Now, could you focus on that conversation? You probably couldn't. One of the things we're talking about today while we try to fix that tape, Winifred Gallagher, her book is called Wrapped, Attention and the Focused Life. Now, Todd, we've been asking people all morning long, what distracts you? What keeps you from that focused life? We would love to hear from you. It's 1-877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org. You know, we've been joking all morning about how tweeting and Facebook status updates and other things can keep you distracted. But the truth is, and Winifred's point is, it can seriously keep you from the life you actually want to live. As William James once said, my reality is what I pay attention to.
That's right. And she was talking about bottom-up attention, the kind of, you know, your brain programs you to pay attention to certain things. When a loud noise goes off or a car's coming at you, you darn well better pay attention to that, and that makes sense. And you can get distracted by things in your environment, but all the other things that we can possibly control, like all those funny things that we're talking about, tweets, Facebook, those little noises going off, chirps, your BlackBerry's vibrating every 4 minutes, you get emails. And look, I know sitting around trying to do my work, trying to write a story or prep a piece, I have to turn my Twitter off, because if I don't, I am all over the place, not to mention the fact that you can't pay attention to anyone else around you and get your work done if you're not focused. She was talking about a top-down kind of attention, deciding what you're going to pay attention to and having kind of this disciplined approach to it.
You know, speaking of what you've been paying attention to, we know that a lot of you have been paying attention to the speech that President Obama gave just yesterday, and I think that we have some cuts from that, and we were going to go ahead and listen to some of that.
Just this week, we've taken steps to protect American consumers and homeowners and to reform our system of government contracting so that we better protect our people while spending our money more wisely. Thank you. It's a good bill.
A smattering of applause there, kind of weak applause. That was a remark on homeowners that the president made. You hear the reverb in that room. That wasn't reverb from our studio. That was reverb from the Grand Hall of the National Archives, because the president was making, of course, his speech on national security policy, Guantanamo Bay, and he started off with a little nod towards his credit card and consumers efforts and one person in the back.
I know, but everyone there was waiting to hear something more like this.
We are less than 8 years removed from the deadliest attack on American soil in our history. We know that Al-Qaeda is actively planning to attack us again. We know that this threat will be with us for a long time, and that we must use all elements of our power to defeat it.
And so the president is a little bit vulnerable to attack, certainly from the right.
So?
Democrats always are, that they're weak on terrorism. You don't want to waterboard. You don't want to do enhanced interrogation. You want to let people from Guantanamo go. Whether or not these things are true, he's vulnerable to that rhetoric. So you see the president at the very top of that speech making it clear that he's tough on terrorism, too. He may have a different approach than the Republicans before him or the Republicans in Congress. He may not agree with enhanced interrogation or torture or waterboarding or holding people without charge in Guantanamo. But, hey, I'm tough, too, people. I know we're at war. I know Al-Qaeda is a danger. I'm not going to let up. That's the message he's trying to send.
You know, if you go to thetakeaway.org, you can see the different conversations that we've had this morning about this very speech. Peter Baker, we were talking to him earlier today from the New York Times, yep, talking about, what did you call it?
Triangulation. It's the geometry of politics. It's a strategy that Bill Clinton was not the first one to do it, but he was the first one to publicize that he was doing it. Triangulation means the people on your right criticize you, the people on your left criticize you, and all of a sudden you're the most reasonable person in the room because you're getting it from all sides.
I was just going to say, isn't that sort of old hat for President Obama, though? I mean, look at what he's done with the abortion issue. He's done that perfectly.
Yes, he has.
To put yourself in between those two. Why is it so necessarily different to do it with an issue like national security?
Well, it's not so much different, except it is important because it's such a heated issue and there's so much heated rhetoric. Look what you've seen just real quickly the last week. You've seen Republicans saying the president wants to release terrorists into our midst. Well, that might not be quite true, but they don't want these detainees coming to the United States. You have liberals on the other side saying we don't need to have these detainees in prison at all. The administration was wrong about everything in the war on terror. Well, people are sniping from both sides. Who's the most reasonable guy in the country? It's the president. He seems moderate. He seems focused. He seems reasonable. And that's exactly where a president wants to be.
Hey, you know, we have been talking about distractions, and I want to get back to that because we are hearing now from some of you out there. Let's go ahead. What keeps you distracted?
My major distraction is my two very young children. I find that they barely can finish a sentence, let alone have a conversation. So a lot of parents would relate to that.
Okay. Listen, we also had Shabadell from Detroit who wrote in to say, I work in an office environment and coworkers are always in constant conversation across my cube. So I put my headphones on and I listen to public radio. Oops. Okay. I think we've sort of been at cross purposes for you today, Shab. Sorry about that. What else do we have here?
I think we're all in danger of being on a short cell phone leash. My strategy is to choose a ringtone that is unobtrusive and mild enough so that it's actually easier to miss the call.
All right. Well, you can tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we're always here on The Takeaway. Go to our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or at iTunes. We have a takeaway for you. Here it is.
We don't really know why we weren't hit in the last 7 years, and if we were hit in the next 4 years, we won't necessarily know whether it's a result of a particular policy change. But certainly that will be the argument people will make. That will certainly be the context in which anything happens. And that's something Obama people are very conscious of.
That was New York Times reporter Peter Baker talking about President Obama's vision for a triangulation strategy that we were just talking about, being in the middle. We've been talking about distractions all day. We've been talking about tweeting a little bit. I would love to have you join my Twitter feed as I tweet from Capitol Hill and from Washington. You can reach my Twitter feed, Todd Zwillick, through thetakeaway.org. Go there and join me.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.